So it's my pleasure to introduce the first speaker of this fall seminar colloquium series. Today it's John Logsdon from the University of Iowa. John did his PhD with Jeff Palmer at Indiana University and then went on to do a postdoc with Ford Doolittle at Dalhousie. He then joined the faculty at Emory University and moved on to the University of Iowa, where he's now an associate professor in the Department of Biology. So John's lab has two primary research arms. The first is focused on deciphering the evolutionary relationships among protists. And the second addresses a really central but still largely unanswered question in biology, and that's the origin of meiosis and recombination, meiotic recombination. So today John's going to tell us about some recent research from his lab on that second research component in a talk entitled Sex Cells, the Origin and Evolution of Meiosis.
All right, thanks Beth and Brett for being my hosts, and congratulate, where's Brett? So right here, sorry. That's what I do, I look right over. Congratulations on you, going through the process yesterday. So I'm glad to be here. So I'm going to tell you about work that has been going on in my lab for a number of years. Sort of it's an overview of the kind of questions we're working on, and maybe provide some answers and hopefully ask more questions, because that's what we're all about as scientists. I feature Nesent on this slide, which is, I'm just recently left Nesent. I was on sabbatical there for a number of years, and it really influenced a lot of my thinking about sort of bringing the kind of science that I do out to a general public, and I hope to be able to tell you more about that in the future. But I'm sort of a Nesent ambassador. So if those of you who don't know about Nesent, which is the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, and want to hear about it, just send me an email or find me afterwards and I'll tell you all about it. I guess Kristen here is the ambassador locally, so you probably all know about it. But anyway, it's a fantastic place. This is my lab. Exactly a year ago, as it turns out. I didn't realize this. I've been using this slide for about a year. And our honorary member. So the work I'll tell you about is largely from these folks. And I have a number of acknowledgments. So Bonnie Malik is not shown in that picture, but a lot of her work is going to be featured in my talk. And she was my first PhD student to really start and finish in my lab. And she's moving on to her own work in various protist evolution stuff. But the work that I'll tell you about is done primarily by these folks. It was started at Emory and is contributed by lots and lots of people, including undergraduates and high school students, and support from both NSF and NIH. So I've been really fortunate to have those kind of both support and smart people to work with. Okay, so this talk is really about beginning to answer some of these big questions in the origin and evolution of meiosis. So what do I think the big questions are? First of all, when did meiosis arise? Did it arise during eukaryotic evolution, sometime preceding eukaryotic evolution? Sort of, we know this is a eukaryotic process, but I wanted to know specifically when meiosis arise. I have something to say about that. How did meiosis arise? And in particular, from what prior functions did this novel set of mechanisms and processes come from? We know that evolution works by reusing things that already exist. It didn't come out of nowhere. So what processes and functions did this new one come from? And given that it did arise, and we know it did, how has it subsequently evolved? Has it been changing holus bolus for 2 billion years of eukaryotic evolution, or is there lots of stasis and a little bit of change? What is the sort of pattern of meiosis evolution? One particular question we're really interested in, and as evolutionary biologists, we're often interested in the exceptions to the rules, right? We want to understand how something works. And even as geneticists, obviously, we knock it out. So what we're looking for answering this question is, are there any organisms that, in fact, have lost meiosis? Can meiosis be lost? And if so, what does that mean? I've got some information on that that I'll tell you about. And then finally, something that Beth sort of brought up in the sort of intersection, which is that, given all this stuff, and I'll tell you a fair bit about answering some of these earlier questions, how does this connect to this sort of bigger question in evolutionary biology, which is why maintain sex at all? And this has been an ongoing question for a long time, that for which there's currently no clear, consistent answer to. But there's sort of two different worlds of thought here, largely in theory with some empirical work. And so I'm hoping to connect up the kind of molecular evolutionary stuff that I'll tell you about with this question. Don't get too excited about it, because it's actually a complex answer, and But that's really the long-term question, which is how do these things connect up? Why is sex maintained? A little bit of an outline of my talk, sort of in four parts. I'm going to talk a little bit about eukaryotic biology. I'm glad that Beth pointed out that a big part of my lab, although it's sort of getting smaller and smaller, it has been focused on eukaryotic phylogeny. What are the relationships among the major groups of eukaryotes? And just like sex, it's actually fairly well unknown and still in progress. We really don't know what the eukaryotic tree of life really looks like in detail, but we've done some work there, and I'll tell you what we know. And the reason why I'm interested in this, one of the reasons, is it provides a roadmap, a context for asking the question about when sex arose and when particular genes arose during the evolutionary history of eukaryotes. We're molecular biologists in my lab, so we use molecular markers for sex, and I'll tell you about our work using meiosis-specific genes. I'll tell you about homologs of RecA, RAD51 and DMC1, and then some other genes that we've worked on figuring out their molecular natural history. Again, with the hopes maybe to connect to some of the functional work that lots of people have been doing over the years. We use what we call a phylogenomic inventory, which is really just, quite simply put, using a phylogenetic comparative way of thinking and looking in genomes to see what pieces and parts are there and then sort of putting those two things together. And the questions we started with that I'll tell you a little bit about are sort of, what are the genomes of what might be some of the earliest diverging lineages of eukaryotes? What do those genomes look like with regard to these genes, Giardia, Trichomonas, these are protists? What components are present? So this will help answer these questions. Where did meiosis come from? How did it evolve? Okay. By taking that sort of phylogenetic comparative way of thinking. And then finally, at the end, I'll tell you about our current work about using this inventory, this natural history, as what we call a toolkit. If we have a detailed natural history about what genes are there and constant or lost, we can use the presence and absence of those genes as a way of detecting potentially hidden sex in organisms that aren't known to have sexual reproduction. We can go into their genomes and look for the genes. And the answer to some of these questions will help us address this, can meiosis be lost? The idea being that if an organism truly is asexual and has lost meiosis, those genes should be gone. And I'll get to that at the very end. Okay. All right, so I start with this sort of phylogenetic tree of life circa when I was a graduate student. So this is based on ribosomal RNA, small segment ribosomal RNA. And our view of the world at the time was that there were two flavors of prokaryotes, eubacteria and archaebacteria, and eukaryotes. And that most of the eukaryotes that most of us as biologists have worked on, and certainly the rest of the world is familiar with, are animals, plants, and fungi, the big ones. And one of the things about this phylogenetic tree was that it illustrated the diversity of other eukaryotes, which are single-celled eukaryotes, protists, which most of us don't work on. And what was really interesting was that molecular diversity might suggest that there was lots and lots of cellular diversity in terms of functions, et cetera. And one of the things that I latched onto pretty early on was the idea that there was a group of organisms or an assemblage of organisms down here represented by microsporidia, trichomonads, and diplomonads like Giardia that at the time were not known to have meiosis and sexual reproduction. So it suggested, given that kind of information in this tree, that maybe meiosis was an invention that came a little bit late after the eukaryotic cell evolved. Okay, and so this is sort of the initial premise of a lot of the work that I did as both a postdoc and then early years in my own lab. But there's two problems with this. One is that this was an initial attempt at a really complex problem. It turns out that the ribosomal RNA tree of eukaryotes anyway had some serious problems with the kind of rate artifacts that we now know are problematic in phylogenetic reconstruction. So now fast forward quite a bit, and this is now getting a little bit dated, but it actually hasn't changed that much. This is actually a modern view of the eukaryotic tree of life, and where we had previous resolution of lots of these protist branches, they've sort of collapsed. Okay, so the organisms we're familiar with, the piscicons, animals and fungi and plants, are sort of just big assemblages. We call these supergroups. And so our modern view of eukaryotic phylogeny is that there are these sort of clumps, these groupings of eukaryotes called supergroups, most of which are protists, right, or at least contain protists. So these are animals, fungi, and protists, plants, and protists. So, but we don't know what the relationships among them are, right? So you see that's a multifurcation here. So we don't really know what the earliest branches are, although it's still possible that some of those early branches that I talked about before, represented by Giardia and Trichomonas, could be among the earliest branches. And there's some evidence consistent with that hypothesis, but let's take into account our uncertainty here. So as science is a lot of the time. Okay. There are a few and fewer along the way that of branches that we don't really know where they go, but we don't really know what the earliest branch is. Well, at the time Andrew Roger and Alistair Simpson wrote this piece, they jumped the gun a little bit, but it turns out they're right, and I'm going to show you that they were right. But they said that the last common ancestor of living eukaryotes based on this appears to be in a complete eukaryotic cell. It had a nucleus, ER Golgi, and underwent both mitosis and meiosis. And they used some generalities about what was known about the distribution of those things across this tree to sort of infer that since most of these lineages had evidence for all these things, that we could put it down to the base. Okay. It turns out we have explicit evidence for meiosis genes that suggest this is the right answer. Okay, and I'll show you some of those data. Okay, so those are the two things, and that begins to answer that first question, is when did meiosis arise? And the data I'm going to show you are that it arose early in eukaryotic evolution, coincident, as far as we know, with the origin of the eukaryotic cell, or prior to. Okay, so let's get back to the replicable RNA tree of life just for context. So this is now that same tree of that blue slide over here, but just now showing the eukaryote just for comparison purposes. So this is now just sort of blown up where all of the dark branches here are all kind of amoebae, right? So you can see that the amoebal protosform is actually widely distributed across the tree of life. But the main thing I want to show you here is, what do we know about how meiosis works? Well, it comes from a very limited set of taxa. So we're up here with our fungal relatives. Again, this is a little bit biased because of ribosome RNA, but it is true that we don't represent a very deep divergence as animals and fungi as far as eukaryotic phylogeny goes. So what do we know about how meiosis works? Well, it largely comes from animals and fungi. Okay, so they're not just a blow up of that part of the tree, the animals and the fungi. Plants are the sort of the outgroup. That divergence might be a billion years or so. Okay. Literally all of the models, all of the knowledge about how meiosis works comes from the organisms shown in these boxes, right? So mice, us, flies, worms, a fair number of different fungal species, and increasingly plants. So from the sort of genetics of meiosis and the molecular biology and biochemistry comes from a fairly limited set of models. Going back to here, you know, we're coming from here and there. And what I really want to know is how meiosis works in general across all eukaryotes. So I want to actually take what we know from those models and then apply it to the rest of the tree of life and make some inferences about who's doing what. What parts are there and how those have evolved. Okay? So now this is back to that sort of more modern but a lot less resolved eukaryotic tree of life, just splayed out in a slightly different way. So the major protist group, so there's opisthokonts, animals and fungi, plants, and then all the rest of these are all protists. Okay? What are the boxes? So there's animals, fungi, and plants. That's what we know about how meiosis works for the most part. Okay? 90%+ of what we know about how meiosis works comes from those groups. You can see they don't represent a huge amount of diversity from the point of view of eukaryotes. What the yellow boxes mean, and it's actually a little bit out of date, are organisms for which we have genomes, either single or multiple genomes available to us. So what we can do is we can take our genome surveys and our knowledge of meiosis genes and ask, what are the homologs of those genes across the eukaryotic tree of life? And that's what we've been doing a lot of. Okay, so that's sort of step number one for us. You might notice there's a big group here that doesn't have a genome. It turns out we're actually looking at the genome right now. Finally, after many years, there's a big group of organisms for which there's a genome emerging, and I'll hopefully be able to talk about that in, I don't know, a few months, I hope. So that's what we're doing. That's our sort of long-term outlook. So let's get back to sex. So I've been talking about phylogeny and meiosis, but the title of the talk was, you know, included the word sex in here. You know, so what does this have to do with sex? Well, when I wanted to learn and understand about the evolution of sex, usually what we're talking about in sex is sort of this process, right? You know, the getting together of gametes. And as a molecular biologist, I wanted to study genes involved in sex that I could study over that huge history of eukaryotes. I should say that eukaryotic evolution comprises certainly more than a billion and probably more like 2.5 billion years of evolution. So in order to study something over that long history, we have to study something that's relatively conserved. And it turns out that I could study genes involved in this part of sex, the getting together of gametes, which might at some level seem preferable, right? Because that's actual sex. But it turns out that the yin to this yang is actually meiosis, right? The reductional division that creates those gametes. And it turns out, as I'm going to show you, many of the genes involved in meiosis are actually conserved enough to study over that depth. Okay? And it turns out, in converse, actually, many of the genes involved in this process are actually some of the fastest evolving genes that we know about. Interesting stuff about genetic conflict and stuff like that, which I'd be happy to talk to people about. But so some of the more conserved genes, some of the most fast evolving genes. So we need to be able to compare apples to apples, oranges to oranges. All right, sex is the rule. What sex is widely distributed across the eukaryotic tree of life, as far as we know. Some organisms need some help. But asexuality is actually quite common. It's actually, in many ways, it's not the exception. It's actually animals, plants, fungi, protists. I'm going to talk about some cases. There's these whiptail lizards. It's widely distributed, but sporadically across the tree of life. And given that it's widely distributed, why does it just not win? Okay. I'm going to tell you about these quite famous organisms called delegate rotifers at the very end. So who is doing it? What do we know about the natural history of sex across the eukaryotic tree of life? So now I'm even getting less and less resolved on my eukaryotic tree of life. This is now a highly unresolved eukaryotic tree. I've put together some of the supergroups here, but the colors represent sort of what we think are groupings of organisms. Maybe not so surprising to most of you, we don't know a lot about the sex lives of protists. Not many people study them. There might be complicated. So the ascertainment issues with regard to knowing about meiosis and sex across a vast majority of eukaryotic life is actually very limited. So we have lots of question marks. We know, and plus signs mean that we know that some or most of those organisms are capable of sex. So we can sort of, since animals and fungi are doing it, we can say that the common ancestor probably was, et cetera. But our ability beyond that is actually fairly limited. Okay? Now that was where we started. I've already sort of given away my answer. Where's the evidence come from? Well, traditionally it's come from, of course, direct observation. We can do population genetics and look for things in, look at linkage, et cetera, and do population genetics inferences on sex. But there's low levels of so sex can actually be accompanied by very, very low levels of recombination, which we might not be able to detect depending on how much money we throw at the problem. Okay, how many loci we look at, et cetera. So we're limited here. So absence of evidence is a problem. Is it evidence of absence or not? Depends on our level of resolution. So how are we going to interpret that? Is if we have lack of evidence from population genetics or observation, does that mean they're asexual, or are they just doing it covertly or not very frequently? And those are the kind of questions that really are problematic for thinking about the evolution of sex. Let's see where this is going. So what we're doing is trying to look at something different. I've already sort of hinted at what we do, which is we just go in the genomes and see if they've got the goods. Right, so if they've got the machinery for doing sex, then we can make the inference without any of this kind of stuff about their capability or lack thereof of doing sexual reproduction via meiosis, right? So a little primer on meiosis. This is my University of Iowa meiosis slide. All the good stuff for meiosis is meiosis one. Meiosis two is just this boring stuff called, it's essentially mitosis. Mitosis isn't boring, but all the new stuff, the innovations that both distinguish meiosis from mitosis and tell us that these genes that are meiosis specific are all these genes that work in meiosis 1. Okay, so all the good stuff happens in meiosis, recombination, and it's really a complex process that we've learned a lot from model system genetics. The main processes that distinguish meiosis from mitosis are recombination, obviously, pairing, the lack of separation of centromeres in meiosis 1, etc. So there's a number of functions, new functions, that distinguish it from mitosis, which means there are, of course, proteins and other molecules that carry out those functions, and we're interested in studying those. Okay. Here's some of the alphabet soup for those of you who are interested in the machinery. There's a whole series of genes and proteins that carry out this process, starting with replication and sister chromatid cohesion. I've just shown, you might not be able to see them, but there's a number of genes shown here in green that we think are meiosis specific. The evidence is that their function is in meiosis and only in meiosis. The black ones are genes that function in other processes, usually mitosis or DNA repair processes, right? So these are obviously not genes that are going to be really helpful for saying if they've got the gene they're doing meiosis. But we use them as positive controls to see if our ways of sort of going after looking at genes is valid, and those genes are sort of more or less expected to be there. But there's a number of processes. It's also not one process. It's not just recombination. It's not just chromosome pairing. It's not just synaptic complex. There are meiosis-specific components in the whole series of machinery that carries out meiosis from replication all the way through crossover and crossover resolution. Okay. So we're trying to assemble, and this list is just keep growing. Over the last 10 years I've been working on this, the list just keeps growing, and thank goodness for a lot of the work that's being done in these model organisms. Okay. So using these meiotic genes to study meiosis, we have to set up some criteria, and I sort of hinted at this already. The genes should be meiosis specific. Use it or lose it. We need genes that we can make a strong inference that given their presence, their function is in meiosis and not some other process, okay? The other is this conservation issue. Since we're trying to study 2 billion or so years of evolution, we have to study a gene that's evolving relatively slow. So we can identify them. We can line them up and say they're homologous, in fact, orthologous. Okay, so we can make inferences that way. And I'll tell you a little bit about it. It turns out a lot of these genes have evolved by gene duplication. This has both been technically helpful to us as well as intellectually kind of stimulating to think about how new functions arise. And I'll touch on that briefly. So if I'm, beginning my assistant professor and I can, do my deal with the devil and say, this is what I really want to have happen, I'm going to, make my meiosis genes, the most useful for my inference will be these meiosis-specific genes will be present in every species known to do meiosis, no losses. And if there are any asexual eukaryotes, they should be gone, right? Use it or lose it. If they lost it a few years ago, we might get lucky and find them in the process of degrading, for example. So they should be absent or non-functional, right? So that's the best case scenario. Well, evolution doesn't really work that way, but that's the best case scenario. So keep that in mind as sort of what we're aiming at, okay? A little bit more about some of the genes. And sort of where they come from. So this is sort of a starting place for thinking about the origin of meiosis. So a central part of meiosis, of course, is recombination. And the recombination mechanism that's involved involves this double-strand break repair pathway, which is also a pathway used for fixing DNA, double-strand breaks. It turns out that, and these are the yeast gene names, it turns out that breaks are made, they get resected, there's invasion and then resolution, et cetera. And these are carried out in mitosis, or in DNA repair, we'll call it mitosis for simplicity, by a set of genes. Okay? But it turns out meiosis also uses the same set of genes in the context of meiosis one, pairing, recombination, and segregation, but it also has this other set of stuff that's meiosis specific. Okay? So you can see that it's more complicated in a way. It's a sort of a specialty developmental process, if you will. If you're a developmental biologist, you can think of sort of something in addition to sort of using a basal set and then having a sort of specified set. And you're wondering, what the heck are the boxes? Well, the boxes are genes that we know have evolved by gene duplication from another gene that does a general function. In some cases where the white boxes are shown here, they aren't actually represented over here. There's some other gene that does some other process, not in double-strand break repair. In some cases, there's a generalist that's involved in mitotic double-strand break repair for which there is a specialist in meiosis that are parallel. They've evolved by a gene duplication. So there's a number of cases just from the observation here that many of the meiosis-specific genes have evolved by gene duplication. So that's hint number one about the origin of meiosis is it didn't come from nowhere. There was a whole set of gene duplications that sort of created this new way of doing cell division through meiosis in this genetic process that thank goodness for. Okay. All right, so the first case I'm going to tell you about was the sort of founding member of my intellectual journey, which is the, so this is a phylogeny of the homologs of REC-A. Probably most of us know about the bacterial recombinase REC-A. It turns out that eukaryotes have homologs of REC-A. Archaebacteria have homologs called RAD-A. The main one is sort of the generalist and is called RAD51, okay, and it carries out all kinds of activities having to do with double-strand break repair, and all eukaryotes have it with one exception, which I'll tell you about in a minute, but there's a specialist version called DMC1. So when we published this a number of years ago now, we could show that the there was a gene duplication that created the meiosis-specific version after the divergence of archaebacteria. So somewhere between archaebacteria, the origin of archaebacteria and eukaryotes. But what was missing at the time were all the rest of those eukaryotes. So if you know the taxon names here, this is all animals, plants, and fungi. Animals and plants represented probably one of the deep divergences in eukaryotes, but it doesn't represent that wide diversity that I was really getting at. So it allowed me to pose this kind of question. So there's just a schematic of what I just showed you, just for simplicity. We have animals, plants, and fungi, and then we've got this branch. It happens sometime, we don't know when, and here's the question. When did this gene duplication occur? Did it occur sometime during eukaryotic evolution, after which there was a divergence of some eukaryotic groups that never learned how to, that predate this duplication, and therefore would never have evolved meiosis? That's sort of the easy way to think about it. And given that ribosome RNA tree, you might be thinking, oh, well, that was going to be Giardia and Trichomonas and those Microsporidia, right? Because they branched early and they didn't have meiosis. But I've already told you that in fact, we've been looking for this green lineage for a long time, and it doesn't really exist. That which means that I'm getting ahead of myself. But the point is that if the gene duplication marks the origin of meiosis, then any organism that diverged after the duplication, then we could, and based on this gene alone, might be able to infer that gene is capable of doing meiosis and evolved after the origin of meiosis. Okay, so how do we do this? So this is sort of early days in my lab, and we still do a lot of this. We use degenerate PCR. There weren't genomes available for most of these protist organisms. There's still not that many protist genomes out there, but they're increasing, thank goodness. So what we did was we got the DNA. We'd often grow up the organisms or get DNA, and we would design degenerate PCR primers to conserve regions. So this is an alignment where the dot matches the top sequence. So this is Rad51 DMC1 in the archaebacterial version. Wherever there's a dot, it's identical in amino acid sequence. So we do this professionally. Some people will say I got tenure using degenerate PCR because this is an approach that really was fruitful for a number of years in my lab. And so we did that a lot, and we still do a fair bit of it. And the result of which was, among other things, we could show, now the protists are all shown here in blue. We have animals, plants, and fungi in here, green for plants, fungi brown, animals red. We've now begun to fill out. So this is just a sort of sketch of what we knew a few years ago. Blue ones are all protists. Notice that there's no green lineage. There's no lineage that diverged prior to the duplication between meiosis-specific DMC1 and the generalist Rad51. What we were including Giardia and Trichomonas, so they're emphasized here. These were those putatively early branches. They were going to be the deepest lineages. Well, they, at least based on this, they didn't evolve. They didn't diverge before the birth of this gene duplication. What really surprised us, however, not only did it surprise us that Giardia had this meiosis-specific orthologue of DMC1, it had two of them, and it to date is the only organism that doesn't have this generalist thing called Rad51. And we think there's an interesting story here that basically this happened at one point and the DMC1 orthologue actually has taken over the function of the generalist. So it's sort of an interesting evolutionary sidetrack of things can happen. And so that was a sort of surprise that I won't have too much time to talk about. So this is a summary to some extent of what we know about this gene. Everybody's got Rad51 except for Giardia. It has two DMC1s. And everything that we looked at with any confidence using degenerate PCR and genome surveys, everybody has DMC1. We were never able to find this green lineage. So that suggests that, at least based on this gene, and it's only one gene, this meiosis-specific gene, that meiosis evolved before the divergence of all the extant eukaryotes that we've been able to look at. Okay, but we aren't satisfied with one gene. I forgot about this slide. So this gen, we just continue this all the time. So there's more blue protists in here, same story. We never find the green lineage. Everybody has either one or the other. Now the phylogeny, it doesn't actually matter whether we get both of them. If we have one or the other and they're phylogenetically nested within one of the other clades, we can infer that the duplication happened after the divergence of that organism. Okay. All right, so what are the other markers? I'm going to tell you little short stories about these other kind of molecular markers. So SPO11 is a protein that creates double-strand breaks, homologs of MUTES, again borrowed from a repair pathway. Components of the synaptimal complex and other proteins involved in strand exchange, cohesins, etc. So there's a variety of machinery I'm going to tell you little molecular stories, natural history about. So SPO11 is a really interesting protein. It's a protein and a function that it's hard to imagine has any other function other than in meiosis. So what it does is at the onset of meiosis, it creates double-stranded breaks on which recombination acts. So it's actually going in there and creating double-stranded breaks. We have this whole set of machinery to get rid of double-stranded breaks. So this is a protein that actually makes them. So it's sort of counterintuitive. It turns out that it's homologous to a protein in Archaebacteria that's a topoisomerase that not only makes double-stranded breaks but also passes the strands, sort of disentangled DNA. But it's missing the components that are involved in the passing of the strands. So it's a sort of standalone double-strand breaker. So it's hard to imagine this protein persisting in a genome to do anything other than make double-strand breaks during meiosis, because otherwise it would be deleterious. Okay, sort of the heuristic. The other thing is that it's not very well conserved. That Rad51 DMC1 thing that I showed you with all the dots on it is actually one of the exemplars of the highly conserved genes. This was a protein that I'm going to show you in a minute what the alignment looks like, but there are these just little conserved blocks. They aren't nearly as well conserved. And when I first put in my first grant, the panel came back to me and said, there's no way you're ever going to do degenerate PCR in this thing. I'm going to show you what the alignment looks like. So here's the alignment. All right. Now, there's no Archaebacteria here. This is animals, plants, and fungi. This isn't even all of eukaryotic diversity, right? But what you can see is that there are these little patches in here where there's a few dots, right? Not very well conserved. But the postdoc at the time, Marilee Ramish, Wisconsin girl, by the way, was not going to be dissuaded by the reviewer's argument, went in and showed that we could do degenerate PCR to pull these things out. So we did that. We pulled them out of Trichomonas and did that. But the point is that degenerate PCR can work if you're really willing to give it a shot. That's the better conserved region. Okay. Thank goodness, though, about that time, genomes were starting to appear that were relevant to our question. Before we started, there were, you know, one or two or three protist genomes. They were all parasites. They were trypanosomes and plasmodium, et cetera. Didn't really represent much of diversity. I mean, they were useful to us. More genomes started appearing, including the Giardia genome, as it turned out. So we began the sort of process of turning ourselves into, you know, medium throughput bioinformaticians. Okay, so this is a slide from that student, Bonnie Malik, that I mentioned. And this is what she spent a lot of her thesis doing, sort of manual bioinformatics. And people say, oh, you're just getting all your data from GenBank and writing the papers. The data weren't very good at the time. They're actually, genome data are much better, but there was a lot of iteration of things going on. And what I will point out is that we did a lot of annotation. But the important thing is that instead of just reporting the things as best blastits or something like that, we actually did the hard work of doing careful phylogenetic analysis to show that genes were what we think they were, right? They were orthologous to genes that we know are functional in meiosis from yeast and, you know, animals or whatever, okay? And in some cases, which we don't do so much anymore, we actually didn't believe the genome so much anyway, so we would actually go design specific primers and then go PCR them out just to be sure. We don't do that anymore, thank goodness. Okay. We did a lot of that. But that's what we do a lot. So I'm gonna tell you some of the stories. So here's SPO11. The surprise from SPO11 is that everybody had. Once we were able to both find it either bioinformatically or using degenerate PCR, everything we looked at had it. So this was that gene that was really a good exemplar functionally for, you know, we expect to find it in meiosis, but we didn't think we were going to be able to find it very easily, but everything we looked at, we had it. And it turned out to be a little bit more complicated. So there's the archibacterial homologue called TOP6A. So it's the subunit, the topoisomerase subunit. It turns out that some eukaryotes have three different versions of it. So plants have this thing called SPO11-1, SPO11-2, and this thing called BIN5. BIN5 is not meiotic. It functions in a kind of DNA repair pathway. But there are these two versions called SPO11-1 or 2, which are present either together or separately, but everybody has one or the other. Note, gene duplication. Another case of a gene duplication. In fact, this is a duplication on a duplication. So that was an interesting answer for SPO11. Everybody has it, and it evolved by gene duplication. All right, so another set of functions in, are called cohesins that we've looked at. And so these are multi-subunit protein complexes that are involved in binding together chromosomes and maintains the sort of pairing, cohesion, I want to say pairing, the cohesion of sister chromatids as they move through mitosis and meiosis. It turns out that, it's like a ring structure, it holds them together. Okay, there are these generalist subunits, SMCs, but it turns out that that they work kind of like a carabiner, right? So so this little thing can be open and closed. It's actually sliced to either release DNA or release it. So they're built around the DNA. But it turns out that there are versions of these that are meiosis specific. Again, there's sort of a pattern emerging to the story, which is that there are generalists, RAD21, and then there's specialists, RAD8, which is a meiosis-specific version of this. There's a regulatory subunit, not very much is known functionally about this thing called SCC3 in yeast, STAG3, meiosis-specific version in vertebrates. So again, ask the same kind of question, what's the phylogenetic distribution of these meiosis-specific versions of these genes? So this one is now the sort of open question one. So this is this subunit, this sort of open closed part of the carabiner. RAD21, everybody that we looked at has RAD21. All the protists are in blue, animals, plants, and fungi are in brown, green, and red. So lots of protists have RAD21. We've, to date, only been able to find REC8 in animals, plants, and fungi. So what does this mean? This is actually even less conserved. And I'm not going to show you an alignment than the sort of SPO11. They're actually really ill conserved. So they're actually really hard to find bioinformatically. So what does this mean? Are these actually absent? In which case, they probably would have to have been lost at least a few times, or can we just not find them? So this is an ascertainment issue at the molecular level. And so we don't know the answer to this question yet. But it's clear that they have all bad gene duplication. We just don't know when. I would argue that given the phylogenetic representation of protists in here, that by definition, they had to either be here or have been here if the duplication history is correct. Does that make sense to people? But it's still an open question. We haven't published that because it's such an open question. This has turned out to be a really cool question, which is this other subunit, which I'll point to here, this regulatory subunit. It turns out that this meiosis-specific version has evolved at least three times in eukaryotic evolution. This STAG3 invertebrates meiosis-specific, probably meiosis-specific in fish, it's just not studied. There's a meiosis-specific version in fungi and schizosaccharomyces. Saccharomyces only has a generalist that works both in meiosis and mitosis. So there's two events of gene duplication for meiosis-specific function. But this is the star of the show. Drosophila has a meiosis-specific version of this gene called SA2, which we have named SNM. The reason being, so what, you know, what's unique about Drosophila meiosis? Well, the boys don't recombine, right? So it turns out not only is this meiosis-specific, it's male meiosis-specific. It's not functioning in female meiosis, so it's a meiosis-specific gene that's specifically involved in male acasmy in Drosophila. And this has allowed us, these specific version. We haven't looked at these really in protists, but at least three times among animals, plants, and fungi. So here's a kind of counterexample to the early duplication. This is something that's evolved by duplication many times, at least three. And this SNM, this specific male thing, has evolved sometime during the divergence of Diptera. So the big two groups of Diptera, mosquitoes and flies, are represented in this tree. I'm going to blow that up in a minute. But that then allows us to ask the question, well, when did male acasmy arise, right? We actually don't know that much about the genetics of most Dipteran flies, except for mosquitoes and Drosophilids. We know a little bit. There's some old literature on house flies, etc. But instead of, you know, sort of, there's some ascertainment issues about, you know, whether people study whether males are recombining or not. So we just decided we'd just go look for when does the gene get born, right? We know that it happened somewhere in here after the divergence of mosquitoes, but when is this male meiosis-specific gene? When did it evolve? So there's the question. We knew from the genomes that from mosquitoes that they had the SA, the generalist. Okay? They didn't have this SNM, this meiosis-specific one. Drosophila had both. So when does the plus occur on the map? And so, degenerate PCR. We don't have all those Dipteran genomes to go after now. And they're starting to fill in a little bit. But a number of people in my lab have attempted this. We design primers to one paralog or the other. We can design primers to hit both paralogs and do lots of degenerate PCR cloning and sequencing. And the upshot of this is not a totally updated version, but you can see that we got some products that were amplified by this specific one, some by the general ones. But what happened, at least in this initial set of surveys, was nobody had SNM, the meiosis-specific one, except for Drosophila. So we looked through these flies provided by Brian Wigman, and we didn't find any of them. So that's the answer shown here, which is we have this gene duplication. So here's the generalist Drosophila version. There's the meiosis-specific one. There's the other duplication. So it happened at least three times. Well, my student Danielle has continued on this, expanded the Drosophila to add all the genome sequence ones, annotated those carefully. Continuing to look by degenerate PCR, we find SA in everybody. We still haven't found anything that has an SNM-like thing that branches here. So we're just getting closer and closer to Drosophila and still haven't found a believable SNM outside of Drosophilas. Okay? So the answer so far is male echasmia arose pretty recently. Looks like Musca doesn't have SNM, although actually we have some hints about maybe a sort of incipient duplication. It looks like there's a few substitutions in an extra gene. We don't really know what the story of the answer is yet, but we look closer and closer and closer to Drosophila. So it's a relatively recent event. But go back and look at this tree. That's evolving like gangbusters. The whole of different evolution is here. And so not only there's a gene duplication creates a specific function, it's evolving like crazy. So there's an interesting sort of duplication divergence story here that we're beginning to tease out. Okay. All right, so quickly I'll sort of, those are sort of little stories. Now I'm going to sort of step back and talk about the phylogenomics, sort of looking across genomes. And this was our first attempt to look at Giardia, that potentially early diverging lineage of protists. And this was our table that we published back in 2005, where the meiosis-specific genes are darkened, and their presence and absence are just shown here by pluses. And at that time, we had seven meiosis-specific genes that we could use as indicators. Okay? And Giardia had five of the seven. And that allowed us to make the strong claim that that was evidence for saxomyosis in Giardia. And it also allowed us, at least at some basic level, assuming that they represented among the earliest diverging lineages, if not the earliest diverging lineage, that it would be evidence for the origin of meiosis being early as well. Okay. So there's Giardia, it's got the goods. We posit it's doing the deed. I was really satisfied to find out a few years later that method to go in and look for recombination in populations, they went and looked carefully, and they had to look really hard. Okay, they had to find, turns out Giardia is mostly clonal. They had to find a place in Chile where the two strains of Giardia, which were genetically distinct enough, they had enough SNP differences between them and that the strains were actually in the village at the same time. They actually found recombinants, and it was consistent with recombination in Giardia. So that was fairly satisfying. It was crossover kind of inference, so it didn't look like it was easily explained by mitotic recombination. And there were multiple events, and that let me write a little piece, which I was quite happy to do. It's nice when it comes around full circle. What I will point out here is, well, what is full circle? The full circle is actually seeing meiosis in the act in the organism, and it turns out that Zach Candy at UC Berkeley has had a couple of students working on it, and they've described this process that looks, to me, a heck of a lot like meiosis. They actually name it something different, but it looks a lot like meiosis. It involves many of these meiosis-specific genes. Okay, so the circle isn't completely closed, but it's pretty close. Okay. That other protist, that early diverging protist Trichomonas, was our next target, and it not only had all the five that Giardia had, it had the two that Giardia was missing. That allowed us to rethink our interpretation that we put forward in the Giardia paper, which was there's MSH4 and MSH5. These are the meiosis-specific mutant S homologs. There was the phylogenetic tree that we provided. The blue branches are the limited protists that were available to us. These are the other paralogs, the generalist paralogs, animals, plants, and fungi. We made the inference that maybe this, in contrast to these other meiosis-specific, maybe this was a late invention, right? This might have been something that got added on. It turns out it's involved in crossover control. You could imagine maybe that was an add-on function. Wasn't widely distributed. Well, my student Banu wasn't really happy with that. And we knew about the Trichomonas genome story coming out. So she went out and did degenerate PCR on MSH415. And now you can see, filling that out with degenerate PCR and with genome surveys, there's blue lineages. So it's widely distributed in protists too. So it's old as well. Just because it was missing in Giardia doesn't mean it wasn't old. Okay. In fact, it's been lost in Giardia probably. Okay. So now this guy is really thinking, okay, how many cases do we have whereby we have this meiosis-specific gene or genes that evolved by a gene duplication from a generalist? And we sort of step back from the data and ask, well, what does that mean? And just, oh, I forgot I had that little bit down there. Oh, this is a long slug, yeah. I hope it doesn't move forward. Okay. Sometimes you mess up on your presentation. It turns out that of the 9 genes we were looking at that were meiosis-specific, 8 of them have evolved by gene duplication either early in eukaryotic evolution for most of these, and we don't really know. I mean, the one exception I mentioned is this REC8 thing, which is only animals and fungi and plants, but at least consistent with the fact that meiosis is a process. Those genes evolved in it, evolved, duplicated early, and therefore meiosis evolved early. And so the origin of meiosis clearly has something to do with sort of a series of gene duplications, maybe easiest the whole genome duplication. Okay. So that's an interesting inference. So as I mentioned, everybody's got SPO11. So this is now sort of going through some sort of historical versions of these inventories. Everybody has SPO11, which was kind of surprising given its lack of conservation, but everything we looked at has it. Some organisms actually are missing some of these meiosis-specific genes. The meiosis-specific ones are now in yellow. This one should be yellow. There's whole swaths. So this now gets to that point of these are genes we know are, you know, having meiosis in sex, but yet they're missing some meiosis-specific genes. So not all these genes are actually necessary for meiosis in all organisms. So that's one message. Intervening taxa have them, which means they're evolved to lose by loss independently, which is another interesting feature of the data. Moving on, historically, it was now 4 or 5 years ago, we begin to fill out more taxa, we add more genes, and you can see now many of the genes are present, all of the genes are present widely, but not all the genes are present in everything. So there clearly is some combination of loss or our inability to find the genes in some of the taxa. Increasingly representing protists, thank goodness. Okay, and showing that meiosis is not a static process, but in fact, much of it is actually conserved. So if you look at Trichomonas and Giardia, our inventory of Trichomonas of these 29, they had 27 of them. That's pretty amazing given the fact that animals and fungi, only some of them actually are retaining all of them. So clearly there's a set that is ancestral, and then there's been independent loss. One of the things, as I've mentioned, is that this inventory begins to allow us to look at these organisms like Giardia and Trichomonas. I forgot to mention Trichomonas wasn't known to have sex. I think I mentioned it early on. Things like Entamoeba, things like the Microsporidium and Cephalozoan. I didn't actually mention that was actually the other third lineage that was really diverging. It turns out that they're fungi. One of the reasons why we don't trust our ribosomal RNA trees very much anymore is because that was a systematic bias in those. So in fact, they are closely related to fungi. They're actually highly degenerate fungi. Not known to have a sex life, but they've got all the goods. So as with the Giardia case, it begins to allow inferences and allows people to go and look for sexual reproduction, which is actually important in things like disease, like thinking about transmission of disease and et cetera. So finding, you know, sort of hidden sex lives in these organisms is one outcome. This is just a Rorschach test for you to show you that we're just moving on, adding more genes, adding more taxa, and it just keeps going on. One of the exemplar, the data just keep growing, and so one of the things we wanted to do is build a way of looking at them in large numbers, and so we decided to focus on one kingdom, one group of organisms among eukaryotes that might tell us sort of how to think more generally about the whole of eukaryotes. It turns out fungi have been well sampled at the genome level. So this is a phylogenetic tree of fungi. And what we've done is we've put together a database to look at meiosis genes across the available fungal genomes, plus adding in, by degenerate PCR, some key taxa numbered along here that might represent either sexual or asexual, shown in red, to look for the presence and absence of these genes. So sort of combining those kind of two approaches. And there's lots of action in fungi. It's really diverse. There's lots of genomes available. So it provides a sort of exemplar kingdom, if you will, to sort of then expand out to the whole of eukaryotic evolution. Just, you know, here's an example of some of the things we do. So there's SPO 11, RIC 8, I've mentioned to you, RAD 51 and RAD 21, those are the generalists. Some fungi, fungi have all of them. Some are missing in some lineages, but some genes are missing in certain lineages, but not others, so there's these cases of loss as well. And it turns out some of these things are actually missing in groups. I forgot to mention, some of these genes are actually work together in a complex. It turns out, we found out later on by molecular studies that actually this is a molecular complex that works together. So if you lose one, if you lose your lug nuts on your tire, you might as well lose your tire. So they're lost all together at once, right? So we're learning something about function, actually, by looking at these patterns. We're doing this systematically. So these are now back to a kind of blast hit kind of analysis, but again, going back to do rigorous phylogenetics, adding more and more taxa, looking at more and more genes across different groups of organisms, you can see that there's a lot of action. And there's a lot of interesting questions, specific questions to be asked. All right, so this is now the summary of most of my talk, and then I've got a little bit of 5-minute ending part. So what I've told you so far is that the molecular machinery for meiosis evolved once and early, prior to the divergence of extant eukaryotes. I didn't tell you about this group, Rhizaria, but what I can tell you, if you promise not to tell anybody, is we found, although this is being broadcast, it doesn't really work, that they have the goods too, right? So we've sealed off that gap as well. And organisms that we thought were asexual, incapable of meiosis, in fact, are nested within groups of organisms that are capable. So those have to represent secondary losses as opposed to primary absences. So that answers that first question about the origin. Okay. So but what about everybody else? Really, those genomes don't represent a huge amount of eukaryotic diversity. They represent most of the groups, but we want to know about the specific cases. Can we use this natural history, the toolkit approach, to address this? So I've already told you that these genes are missing in organisms we know are capable of sex. So the presence or absence of one gene is not enough, so we have to use a series of genes. There's lots of asexuals to look at, but in the end, we're starting with this one called Delig-Rutherford, which I'll tell you just a little bit about. In the end, is everybody doing it? To answer this question, if everybody isn't doing it, then that suggests that meiosis is not a necessary process for being a eukaryote. If they are, that tells us something about biology. All right, so this is the fun part. So let's pick a random asexual organism. Turns out I did a lot of web searching and then had to delete my cache because, you know, you do asexual reproduction. Gross. But it turns out that SpongeBob, according to his creator, is asexual. So let's go and do the test. Let's see if SpongeBob is really a Bob, for one, and is he asexual? Traditional, go look for recombination in population. If you find evidence for recombination in population, you could use that as evidence. But let's say SpongeBob doesn't do it very often. Are meiosis genes present? Obviously, we go and grind up SpongeBob. Sequence his genome. If the genes are present, we go, yes, we can go back and do the recombination. That's what they did in Giardia. How many? Which ones? If SpongeBob only has one meiosis-specific gene, he's probably not doing it, right? That one gene is probably doing a new job. We know that happens. Which ones? Is it just one function or is it multiple functions? Are they expressed? Are they expressed developmentally in one part of the body that would be consistent with the germline, or not? When and where? We know temporally what order these genes are expressed, so we can use that knowledge. Are they functional? We're building a yeast test system to drop them in and do complementation and dominant negative kind of thing. Finally, if the answer to all this are yes, we can continue writing our third NIH grant to then say, okay, can we get SpongeBob to do meiosis in the lab, right? And if he can be induced, then he's no longer a putative asexual, and we don't really want to know what's going on. Taste salt. Okay, so that's the sort of strategy, the long-term strategy in my lab, and we're in various places on this for different organisms. I'm going to tell you about the stars of the show briefly. These are the girls. These are Delig-Rutherfords, all females. They reproduce parthenogenically. They make daughters that are identical to themselves. There's one making a daughter right now. Their closest relatives are monogonot Rutherfords. They reproduce. They're cyclical parthenogens, so they reproduce sexually. Sometimes, not most of the time, but then mostly reproduce asexually. When things get tough, they induce sex. So have these lost the ability to do meiosis and sex? Because obviously ancestrally they were able. There's lots of evidence about sex and meiosis and doublet. So the best case, including things like allelic heterozygosity, which I don't have time to talk about, but the idea being that in the absence of sex, your big A and little a alleles don't recombine and they start diverging from one another over time. That's the Meselson effect, so-called Meselson effect, shown here. But you can get that kind of genetic divergence effect between alleles within an organism that's asexual by another process, or at least the apparent version of this, which is polyploidy. So even though there's evidence for this sort of allelic polymorphism in delayed rotifers, another interpretation is that those versions came about by a genome duplication. And now there's certainly evidence in monogonine rotifers, there's emerging evidence from delayed rotifers that there's something going on there. So some of the best evidence for asexuality in delayed rotifers has now been at least called into question. And so the genetic evidence suggests, these are all based on consequences, but we're asking sort of what do they have the goods, and using this machinery approach. We have the meiosis detection toolkit, including these genes, same thing, meiosis specific, et cetera. Repeating the degenerate PCR, easier said than done, says my postdoc, Andrew Shurko. So here are the data I'm just gonna briefly show you, is that there are the monogonons, they've got all the goods. And it's really hard to get at the delayed genes because we don't have a genome. And the genomes are big, but we found evidence across the diversity of taxa for some of the genes, okay? So they've got some of the goods, all right? I could show you some of the data, but I think I'm gonna skip it. We do degenerate PCR and we do phylogeny to confirm them, but the answer is that they have the goods. And so there are the monogonons, they've got all the goods, and we have sort of a lot of missing data, but all the data that we have are consistent with them having meiosis-specific genes. Okay. Interpretations, and then I'll finish up. How do we interpret the presence of those genes? We didn't expect to find meiosis-specific genes if they really are asexual, right? There's the obvious one, right? They're doing it, okay? But that's not the only one. Maybe they lost it yesterday. Those genes are there. They're just sort of in the graveyard of genes, and they aren't expressed, in which case they'd be degenerating. We don't have enough sequence data to be sure that they aren't evolving at a sort of neutral rate, but all these are open reading frames that we've found so far. So it's inconsistent with this hypothesis. Here's a really good one. They've gained novel functions. It turns out one of the other interesting biology features of delayed rotifers is that they're desiccation tolerant, which is a DNA repair function. And maybe they're doing that. Automixes, are they rotifer genes? We have lots of things to do, which I won't belabor. I'm going to answer the questions and then finish. So the answers are, when did meiosis arise? Early. We have pretty good evidence for this answer. How did it arise? By lots of gene duplication, maybe one big burst. From what functions? A lot of it came from pre-existing functions in DNA repair and other kind of DNA handling, which makes sense. How has meiosis subsequently evolved? Did it get fixed and then that process is sort of sticking there? The answer is no. There's been lots of gene loss, some gene gain, some new things evolved, and more gene duplication. Can meiosis be lost? Stay tuned. I think no, but it's not definitive, and the big question, again, is more of stay tuned. How to connect this to the sort of bigger theory about evolution of sex and recombination. I'm hoping this will provide some connections, but thank you. I'll be glad to take some questions. Yeah?
So you touched on this a little bit when you said that it might be most easily explain some of the duplication just by invoking whole genome duplication. Mm-hmm. Have you gone hunting for any evidence to genomes that we have, whether it seems to be a lot of segmental or a lot of whole genome?
Yeah. So if this genome duplication that I'm invoking happened, it happened 2 billion years ago. Yeah. Probably there's not much evidence. The other thing is the reason we know about things like segmental gene duplication and stuff in organisms like ourselves is because we have dense sampling. And we can do comparative analysis. So we have exemplar genomes that each of those branches might represent, 100, 200, 300 million years of evolution. So we don't have good comparison points to make those inferences. And gene order is not, among deep divergences of eukaryotes, is not retained. So our ability to answer that question is not very good. We get to make this inference. The other thing, just if I may, to add to the question is, meiosis doesn't make any sense unless you talk about a diploid anyway. So you got to think about a diploidization anyway, which is inherently a genome duplication in a way. So there's some connection to polyploidization, diploidization, and maybe here. And I'm sort of working through the sort of details and trying to write that up at some point. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah, at the back.
Can I ask you about a special case or comment on it, if you can, about candidate alkans? So this is an organism that doesn't have all the goods, but clearly is descended from things that do. And people tried pretty hard to find meiosis. We found meiosis genes expressed, you know, those kinds of things.
Yeah, so I'm, as you know, I'm a little familiar with the Candida albicans story. They actually don't have all the goods, but they've got a lot of the goods. So in fact, Candida albicans has more of the goods in terms of meiosis-specific genes than other related Candidas who are known to be sexual. So this correlation between the present, the quantitative presence-absence of things is a little bit dodgy. I would argue... And I've talked to David Soule, who's a colleague of mine at Iowa, about this, is that as hard as people have looked, and that's a really good case where people have looked really hard, we just haven't looked hard enough. I mean, we're going to find it. And David actually agrees with me on this point, is that we just haven't done the right thing. We haven't, you know, played the right kind of mood music or turned the lights down the right way or put the temperature, you know, whatever. There's lots of organisms we don't know what's going to allow their sexual reproduction to go forward. And so I'm hoping within my career that somebody will find sex in Candida albicans. There's evidence for recombination, which is really interesting, so they may have subverted it for another process. So this is a special case that might prove the converse, which is they use a meiosis recombination machinery to do this weird thing, which is this sort of...
Because it does happen, right?
So yeah.
They mate with each other.
They may, but they don't do the reductional division, and there's some interesting biology. Again, the exceptions are really illustrative, but we need to study them carefully. Yeah. Yeah.
Has anyone in your lab or elsewhere started to look at correspondences between recombination rates or overall chromosome numbers and particular kinds of variation you see, not just gain of loss, but also maybe sequence?
Beth, want to answer that question? No, the answer is no. We don't really. I'm aware of the recombination rate stuff, and Beth told me about her work, and you'll hear about it next week, I guess. One pattern that we're aware of is the sort of need to have at least one crossover per chromosome arm, which is pretty consistent across, and which has to do with the function of segregation in meiosis, and that is related to overall recombination rates and genome size. I'm really interested in this question. But again, we have a serious ascertainment bias with regard to most of eukaryotic diversity. So I think the way to start here, which is I think largely what people like Beth have done, is look at exemplar lineages of things that we know something about, and then make some inferences on that, and then sort of think about generalizing it broader. But I don't really know the answer to the question. I think it's an interesting one that addresses this sort of what's the relationship between the presence and absence of some of these specific things? I don't know. Everybody's got RAD51, is it related to the rate of evolution of some of these proteins? I don't know.
You've alluded a couple of times without coming out and saying it, that we can categorize it as a qualitative phenomenon, or we can look at it as a quantitative trait, perhaps.
Yeah. It turns out that probably recombination rates don't vary. I mean, unless there's ones that are completely... asexual, like, so for, you know, male flies, the recombination rate is zero. It's actually probably not zero, because there's some mitotic recombination probably, but within meiotic recombination, that question of what the range is, what I was talking to Brett about right before this, and I think those are interesting questions that might connect to the machinery or not, I don't know. Yeah.
Even though you're phylogenetic coverage within eukaryotes, the spot, it seems like the organisms that you are studying span a nice range from, you know, free living to obligate parasites.
Thank you.
Do you notice any relationship between the frequency or the number of meiosis-specific genes or the frequency of duplications and the lifestyle of the organisms? And that kind of gets to your last big ultimate question about, you know, why this might be happening.
Yeah. So let me just preface that by those early diverging lineages that we thought were going to be the ancestral absent, Giardia trichomonas, Microsporidia, these are all parasitic organisms. Reduced genome size, there's lots of things that made people think that they were actually ancestral things that, in fact, they're reduced, right? So they started from more complex and they're reduced. Fooled a lot of us, actually. A lot of people were a little worried about it. It turns out that probably... the coverage in PROTUS is actually includes a lot of parasites still, because those are ones that the funding agencies want to know about. But they do represent that diversity. Increasingly, people are doing more free living things. I think our ability to ascertain free living versus parasite with regard to meiosis is, we're not quite there yet. We see some shared patterns, but whether that's chance, some of those patterns are also, like some of those gene loss are also in free living things. So I think those are interesting questions that require more data, but they're kind of obvious ones about what you lose. I mean, these are, the NE of these things, of these parasites is really quite low. So how, you know, they're often quite clonal. In general, like this Giardia case I was talking about, each lineage, there's no evidence for recombination, but you have to sort of put two things together to find it, probably pretty rarely. Do they become dead ends eventually? I would guess probably. They're clonal for a long time, and then they peter out, and then some new clonal lineage, which hasn't quite experienced the ratchet or whatever function, whatever mechanism you want for sort of causing extinction, sort of comes in and replaces. So I think what we're seeing certainly are ones that persist, but I don't know, we're able to answer that question yet. Long answer to the simple question. Andy.
Have you looked at these, you've used your toolkit on kind of on the relatively recently diverged or relatively recently emerged basic tools that we know are all over the place?
Right. So Andy is alluding to my colleague at University of Iowa who did her PhD in the same lab that Andy did, these snails, Potamopyrgus, which are these relatively recent, I would call them, Maureen calls them ancient, I'm sort of chider for this, they're old asexuals maybe, half a million years maybe. So this is something that I've really been looking at. And the fungi in the genomes were sort of picked a bunch of putative asexuals. What we really want to do is we want to catch something in the act of losing a gene. So we want to correlate the absence of sex with the loss. So I've made all these inferences about if you aren't doing it, you're going to lose the gene. But I've never shown you a case where I can show you that, yeah, they aren't doing it and the gene is eroding. We see the before, the gene's there, and we see the after, the gene's not there, but I want to catch something in the act. In fact, that was one of the motivations for the Deloitte study, was that it was the best case scenario, right? It's young enough that we might have been able to catch them in the act, but surprise, surprise, they've got many of the goods. We've not found a meiosis-specific pseudogene, which is sort of the gold standard for catching them in the act. We've not found that yet, but I'm constantly sort of looking through taxa to sort of say, okay, this will be the one, and we go after it, and they've got the genes. So there's probably a short window over which you lose the function. The gene gets lost, and either they go extinct, or there's, you know, there's not. I haven't sampled carefully enough.
Is it worth it to do actual sort of sequencing and rate of evolution stuff in recently developed?
Yeah. So Maureen and I are trying to do this kind of thing in the Potamopyrgus, where there's been independent or separate. I shouldn't say independent, but separate origins of asexuality in these sexual asexual pairs of snails at different ages. So yeah, exactly. I mean, we've started working on it. It turns out, you know, the snail genome's not done, you know, so there's classic kind of problems in biology. The interesting biology questions are in organisms that aren't models, are often the case. So we're kind of in the process of engineering a genome project for this organism at this time. And there are other ones too, but that's a key one that probably you'll smile about. So any other questions? All right, it's been a pleasure to be here. Thanks.